I'm Emma Newberry, and you're listening to one of our breakout sessions from Jewish Rhodey Media, where we take conversations further and think more deeply with the guests who join us behind the mic. Today, I'm sitting down with Rabbi Barry Dollinger of Congregation Beth Shalom in Providence, Rhode Island. A few weeks ago, he concluded a trip to the Ukrainian and Polish border with the Rabbinical Council of America. He's here to share what he experienced during his time there and to carry those dual feelings of hope and despair back to our listeners, to remind us all of the urgency and impact of war, even when it has somewhat faded from mainstream media coverage. The UN reports that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has displaced approximately 12 million people, with over 5 million of them fleeing to other countries in Eastern Europe. Because of the almost 330-mile-long border that the two countries share, Poland has become one of the largest havens for those fleeing their homes across Ukraine. Rabbi Dollinger shares what it was like to be positioned at the border between the two countries, always in flux, getting snapshots of how the war has affected people's everyday lives.
My name is Barry Dollinger. I am the rabbi of Congregation Beth Shalom, modern Orthodox synagogue in Providence, and I like to dabble in spiritual startups of different sorts. So the Rabbinical Council of America is a group of Orthodox rabbis, the largest group of Orthodox rabbis in the United States and Canada, as they say. And they were going to have an annual convention in Chicago, but got the idea, a good idea, that instead of a convention, we should do some kind of service mission of chesed, of loving kindness. The obvious choice became to serve Ukrainian refugees. I was on the fence about the convention in Chicago. It had been a few years. And as soon as I saw this, I said, oh, okay, that's that I will go to. What it was a trip to Poland and the Ukrainian border. One of the things that became clear to me is, you know, there's some amount of material assistance we could provide on the ground there, but actually we're there for, you know, a better part of a week. That wasn't going to be like the difference maker, that what would really matter is kind of seeing firsthand what was going on and coming back and kind of bearing witness and telling other people about a story that shifted out of the attention of the media. But I went because, you know, we said, gosh, throughout history, right, we've grown up in our house hearing stories of like people that took in Jewish refugees during the Holocaust and people that helped and the righteous of the nations. And like, here people need help. And like, are we really too busy? And it helped as we were deliberating that our older daughter, she's 3.5, was, you know, like, what's war? Well, of course you should go help them, you know? This moral clarity of if people need help and are in a bad situation, go help. So I was sent away to go help. One of the most important things to say at the outset is the Jewish community of Poland decided that it was going to use its official organs and turn them all into primary care refugee assistance, and that they would not discriminate between Jewish and non-Jewish refugees in any way. They shifted their focus. And so the JCC of Krakow is food service, material supplies, and daycare, and like all of the space has been repurposed for this purpose. And the other people find ways to try and keep doing what they're doing. But like, this is the main thing. So that was really inspiring. So the media really is focused on like the missiles and the military strategy. I haven't seen a story about who's at the border and how like a relatively small handful of organizations and volunteer doctors, like 5 or 10 of them at a time at each of 8 border crossings that exist, are providing all of the attention to 4 million refugees. There are millions of people who have fled on foot because the roads have been destroyed and lined with landmines. Their homes have been, and they have nowhere to go. And men are staying to fight. They have to stay. So it's all women and children. We would go to places and there'd be hundreds or thousands of people waiting in line for food for miles. So the food lines would sometimes be thousands or even, we're told, tens of thousands of people long. I saw people at border sites, just over the border, crossing in, at centers. At the border, as many people are going as coming. So at first I thought, oh, well, the conflict is waning in the West and people are returning. There are huge lines to go back. I started to speak to people going back. And what I quickly realized is many of the people coming the other way, leaving Ukraine to go to Poland, this was at a site called Medica, were leaving for the second or third time. This wasn't their first refugee experience. And many of the people going back were going back with the expectation that they'd be back yet soon. And so I started to ask, well, what's going on? And so the answer was, well, we have elderly relatives left at home who couldn't make the journey by foot. And so we go back to check on them when it's quiet. But the roads are destroyed and our house is partially destroyed and there's no gas and there's no food in the supermarkets and there's landmines everywhere. Yesterday I was listening to the Public's radio and they were like, folks allege that landmines were everywhere. You could see the road, the forest was carpeted with landmines and drones trying to remove them. It's not like there were, we tons of land. What's the allegation? Just look at them. There they are. And people's limbs are being blown off left and right. Like people, because of the landmines. So people are going back to check on elderly relatives, but knowing that nothing is left, even of places that are safe. And a lot of people are going back in despair. Like, I came here, couldn't find a job, I couldn't find housing. And so I don't know, I'm just kind of wandering around. I guess I'll go back. Like, so that's one thing that I think the narrative is missing, is kind of the despair of wandering refugees. And it would be easy to think like, oh, they're going back, it's safe now. But like, that's not really what's going on. There's a human interest that should be the main story about like a network of volunteers who uproot their lives to come assist, and really resilient people. Like, resilience was the theme when you spoke to people. Like, we're going to be strong, we're going to be tough, we're going to grow from this. I met a doctor from Maine and a doctor from Washington State, and Clementina, a college kid from Cleveland. I think she was at like Case Western or something. And she decides to take a leave of absence because her family's Ukrainian and she speaks the language, to go run the food distribution at the JCC, because she's like 19, but she's good at logistics. And she's just like, she's become in charge. She's distributing food to like 10,000 people a day. Another misnarrative is the role of technology. So on a line at the JCC in Krakow, the best site, by the way, that we saw, in my opinion, in terms of actual serving. So I spoke to this one kid who was on a tablet online. So I think this kid was like 6 or 7. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm in school. He said, oh, the same way we did it during the pandemic. Our school is on Zoom right now because we're all over the place. And I, while I'm online here to get food every day, I go to class. And they have therapists and social workers, and we check in on each other and the teachers process. And I saw another little girl, and she was on WhatsApp, and I was speaking with her, and she's like, this is my father. And he had a weapon and was in a bunker, and there were like shots being fired. And he was just checking in. It's not like my father has gone off to war. It's like, here's my father, the warrior, on video chat. Watch him shoot. And I was like, oh, wow, this is a different conflict, because people are using the technology to stay in school, like for the limited function of keeping people safe and in touch. I don't know. So I was just like, where's the stories about how the technology is changing the, you know, human interaction of kids and their parents at war, or how schools maintain, or how volunteers from colleges in America who happen to speak Ukrainian have gone over in large numbers to help out?
A lot of the stories that Rabbi Dollinger told were uplifting, stories of connection. But there are, unfortunately, certain specters that don't just vanish in the face of conflict. In fact, they rear their heads even more. One of Rabbi Dollinger's spiritual startups, as he calls them, is Mitzvah Matzos, an organization that raises money to end human trafficking through the sale of matzah. So, as you can imagine, that phenomenon, especially at a border site, was on everyone's mind.
At the sites where like women would sleep at night at the border, there's someone guarding always to make sure that they like are safe, because you have women and children, right? This is a high-risk situation, women and children. And then this guy who's the mayor of Medica, we didn't know that at the time, comes, he's in a suit, he's a tall guy, he comes down from a watchtower. He starts asking us all these questions. And at some point someone's like, why are you giving us, like, we're here to help, why are you asking us so many questions? He says, well, a lot of the people who've been here to help are traffickers, or I think they're human traffickers. And so I'm the mayor of this town. And so I sit all day, every day, to see who's here. Because I will, and this is a small, politically conservative Polish border town. And here's this mayor who I think built himself a watchtower. It's like, I got the feel that he built this watchtower. Yeah. And like, he's looking to make sure that people are not trafficked out of his sight. And he sits there all day to see who's there and to know what's going on at his border, he called it. And he took like personal care to know like who's there. He knew who was there, not just the volunteers, the refugees. And maybe we'll flag this under like individual heroes also. Like there was no committee meeting. No one approved like an anti-trafficking initiative at this border situation. There was no budget allotment. Like the mayor was like, I'm gonna watch.
We'll be right back after this short break.
In today's world, everyone is having a conversation. But how do you get your point of view to stand out? Do you ever wish you could just cut through the noise and have the time to really connect with someone, even if you're coming from different viewpoints? Jewish Rhode Island is bringing back The Conversation, an open format section of our paper where readers are encouraged to submit their thoughts on a predetermined topic, highlighting the diverse opinions that make up our community. The best part? It's driven by you. Jewish Rhode Island is now soliciting input on topics submitted by you so that the conversation we're having includes the most important perspective of all, yours. Starting this fall, The Conversation will be featured online and in our print newspaper. Contact us at editor@jewishallianceri.org to make your voice heard.
One of the points Rabbi Dollinger brought up again and again was that there wasn't a lot of coverage of who was actually present at the border, helping. So I asked him, who all was actually there?
There were two countries that had like aid in addition to the UN at the border. I was used to the Israel thing, and they had different, there's an organization, Hatzalah Lelo Gvulot, Rescue Without Borders, that was providing like emergency medical service. And then the Israeli government was also running some of the primary shelters at the border for people to sleep overnight until they transfer on. And the people who were staffing those, like medical staff, were random doctors. Like I met a woman who's like a cardiologist. She's like, I'm just here on a 2-week stint. I'm like, oh, are you like Jewish? I'm not Jewish. I'm like, oh, so like this non-Jewish cardiologist is here in this Israeli medical tent at the border of Poland and Ukraine helping whoever, like a refugee of some other background. Mm-hmm. And so there was like real blurring, but the Egyptians were also there. Like there was like Israel and Egypt and the UN and World Central Kitchen. And there are these tents at the border. That was one story of like these places, Israel and Egypt.
You said that you your ancestors are from that area. Is it Poland specifically?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I know my grandpa Eddie's on the immigration papers on ancestry.com. It says Galicia. That's what it's because it was really an autonomous region. So, that could have been Ukraine. And I know on my mother's side, you know, there were the Olshanetskys and the Olshanskys. And that is from a town that's now in central Ukraine and probably is also Galicia region officially. And so your family's also from there?
Yeah, we had some, I guess, modern day Belarus, Minsk and Pinsk.
Yeah. What was Poland?
It's obviously very different now, but that ethos that you're saying, like it does tie you and there are these sort of residual, like, I don't know, I'm almost afraid a little bit to go back.
It's this weird thing, but I've been there a few times. Every time I go, even though the tour groups are kind of like, my pet peeve is everyone's focused on like death of Jews. And I'm like much more interested in the vivid life that like Jewish communities had for like a millennia in these places than like how the people that chose to slaughter us chose to do. I mean, that was part of it. So much as that was part of the Jewish experience, but like, I don't know, it's not the thing that, and when I'm in there, I actually feel like home. I don't know if it's just because of the stories or the geography or, this came to a fore at the JCC in Krakow. I was talking to this woman online for food, an older woman, and she actually like grabbed my shirt. Like, this older Ukrainian woman was like, uh-oh. And she's like, let me tell you something. My parents, they chased your ancestors out of here and they probably did worse. And the reason I come to the JCC to get food is because I know that you people know, so she said it, what we're going through, because we put you through it. I had this reaction, first of all, of like, that sounds really cynical, but then also it's really true. And then also I had this sense that it's not because of your, whatever your, you know, father did to my great grandfather or something, like, which may have happened, but like that consciousness of Jewish, like this is where the rabbi moves, like, no, the Torah says, you know, Atem yedat temet nefesh akar, you know the soul of the refugee because you were strangers in Egypt. It's like, I mean, it doesn't have to go back to Egypt per se, but like Jewish consciousness for a long time has had like even a legal or moral strain shaped by like refugee or other status. And that existed way before the Holocaust, right? Or pogroms or the Inquisition or like any number, like it was just reinforced and cemented in Jewish history. And so I felt myself thinking, you don't know how deep that, even though I've lived a very cozy life, right? Like in upper middle class settings, but like that consciousness is, I don't know. So I wound up feeling like this is such a Jewish issue, even for a group of Orthodox rabbis that don't match necessarily, like this isn't even a political liberal Jewish, like mainstream Jewish, most Jews are Democrats. This is an overarching Jewish religious, cultural, social ethos. I really did wind up, like I was just having those thoughts. The rest of the world's attention is diverted from this situation. But like what I observed was not what the media reports. I observed a whole different set of things. And there was just human interest vignettes, right? Like this other kid who was playing spike ball online, 5 years old. I asked him, how are you doing? He's like, I'm doing okay during the day, but at night I have nightmares. They give me sedatives now and it's better. And I just started crying. And he said, well, we all just take Valium now. And so when the sun comes up, it's less scary. Now, I don't remember the night. And I couldn't help but wonder, like, is this enough? Are we really learning these lessons? I don't know, it's a challenge.
We'll be right back.
When speaking to the people, like unless really prompted, most of them did not speak about the doom and despair. They spoke about either survival or like who was helping them or how they were moved to like become or what they were doing in their lives. We went to the yeshiva in Lublin. It's like one of the great prominent yeshivas that's now like a hotel and series of restaurants and things in Europe. And there was this kid there. So I'm speaking to this kid and like, what's going on? He's like, I'm learning to read the Torah. And here's this yad, you know, a hand to read the Torah that I brought from my community in Lviv. And I'm going to keep using it here. And because I brought it, I wanted to learn to use it. And I'm in school and I got a new puppy. And here's the puppy. And like, you know, this kid was speaking about his new puppy. He's living in refugee housing, but like he has a life, you know, like these are people and like people have daily lives and whatever he went. So that I think that's what people wanted to speak about. The girl wanted to like play her violin song and people like talk about how much they enjoyed a nice hamburger on a grill. I don't know. People do not define themselves in general by the horrible things other people choose to do to them in traumatizing ways. Like people have aspirations. I left feeling that very palpably. Like in every situation, like human beings aspire, those aspirations are connected and positive. We were at a site. It was a retreat center in the woods in southeast Poland, which I think a lot of listeners would know as Galicia. On Lag BaOmer, they were having a barbecue for the refugees. There are hundreds of people just singing and dancing and in a really, the emotion, you know, it's like in America when Jewish organizations hold like a Lagba Omer bonfire. They're like trying to prompt engagement. But here it was like people needed warmth and they needed camaraderie, and the emotions of the songs or the words were true catharsis, and people would just hug each other or hold hands and cry. And there was no instrumentality about it. Like, we're doing this to try and get to that, or what? Like, this was like a spiritual experience, really, a deeply transcendent experience of people in the woods, alone in nature, beautiful, bonding when everything else is up in the air and precarious, and was really inspiring. I have to say, repeatedly on this trip, there was more inspiration. Like, there were the really dark elements, like landmines, but the really inspiring things were that the humanity of people who didn't know each other, many of them couldn't even speak each other's languages because there were Poles there and Ukrainians there and Americans there and Israelis there, other people, Turkish rabbis.
Yeah.
And so in the dining hall of the retreat center, this one young woman, Nicole, had come a long way on foot. And she mentioned that the only thing she brought other than her backpack with like a stuffed animal and some things was her violin. And she just takes it out and closes her eyes and starts playing the violin. And we're just like a different world.
This is a short excerpt of Nicole's playing, recorded by Rabbi Dollinger. She's tall but slight and has long blonde hair that's pulled back into a low bun to get it out of the way for playing. She looks maybe 12 or 13, even younger. She came to the wooded area over the border on foot from Dnipro, almost 800 miles away, in the east of Ukraine.
The music did kind of transport all of us, I think, in this way that kind of went through, because the violin also is this very vivid expression of like pain and deep emotion. The way she was playing it also, it was just, she had all this experience she was putting into her concerto.
If you think about like depictions of Jewish refugees through history, at least for me, the biggest one artistically is Chagall, and he always has the violinist there as the witness to the historical experience of Jews. So when I saw that, it was just it was a very meaningful call back to me. Did your daughter have questions for you when you came home?
Yeah. Ada, she likes her English name now, although we loved her Hebrew name, but she's insistent on using her English name. So Ada really wanted to process a little bit, like, so what's a war? Well, why would people want to hurt other people? And why would a whole country, like, trying to process, like, she could process the playground, you know, people don't want to share. And
well, it's a pretty good allegory. Yeah,
and it's like, and why that is, you know, and so I asked her, like, well, why? And she's like, well, so at some point she said, well, maybe Putin didn't get enough sleep at night and he's cranky. And I'm like, you know, so like there's this interesting thing that happens with three-year-olds where like they kind of see pretty clearly what's going on, which is like, yeah, he's got problems and his problems are leading, like, psychological and emotional are leading to a lack of, you know, pro-social behavior.
Right.
And when it's at the scale of countries, you know, houses collapse, she kind of got that. And even death, you know, so like, she's also kind of placed it because she just watched The Sound of Music when we were home with COVID. And she processed, like, oh, this is a war. It's like what you went over to. Because the three-year-olds over there, like, some of them describe seeing their houses blown up by bombs and escaping rubble. And, like, I mean, there's going to be trauma from that. But, like, it's going to handle a lot. And they can have like clearer perspective than adults. No, one kid was like, I was stuck there and I was asking for help and like someone heard me and they removed the stuff and it took a while, but then they helped me out and a doctor came and helped me. And it's like a kid is describing having their house blown up and being pulled from rubble. And they were like five or something. But they were just describing like, that was a nice man who helped me.
I did excerpt one of the things that you wrote. So I would just ask if you would want to expand on it or just talk about what you were feeling when you wrote this. Amidst all the pain, the telling warm smiles I've shared with refugees without any language or even much else, what do I know of the struggles they're undergoing? In common, deep human affection and knowing glances feel to me like an improbable and vast source of hope, like I haven't felt in a long time. And perhaps reflective of the deep spiritual connection that manifests paradoxically during crisis.
I think I wrote that at the border, I believe, at Medica. It was sunset at the border, which is just a kind of experience, right? And like, there's not much else around. There's a kind of trail of people, a person, and a minute later, another, usually a mother and a kid, other backpacks come in for a while, stop and get water. Or candy. A lot of them didn't really speak our language, or like I felt so, like, what do I say? And a lot of them would just look at you, right? And the kids would smile to see a friendly face, and they would know they're at the border and see tents of medical attention, food, and other things. But they're there in this kind of very impromptu tent village of aid organizations, like Israelis and Egyptians and rabbis, like with their yarmulkes at the border, like, hey, welcome to, you know, it's just like, and like some of them, you know, they describe like, I've been walking for like 100 miles on foot, you know, and it's like, and they're little kids with their backpacks and their stuffed animals usually. And you just look and they like stare at your eyes. And it's just this thing of like, I feel like the only thing I could say to them with my eyes was like, I can't imagine what you've been through. And also, I think I know what you've been through. Like, right? In other words, like, I don't know what it's like to walk 100 miles and maybe have lost a relative or not know what the feel like. I don't know that at all. But and then part of me felt like when they looked, it was like, no, you're here. You're here because you know that we are struggling. And like, I am here to see you. Like, they connected. Right? The smiles weren't just like seeing a smile. There was this emotion of like, they felt like hugs of like, oh, and we're like, we're not alone. And I felt not alone, not that my feelings were so important, but like I processed through my emotion. And like, clearly they felt not alone. And that to me felt, especially with the sunset and kind of the natural scene, like, well, there is this like deep energy of love and connection and whatever else is happening, this has got to be so much deeper and more like ontologically prior, more significant than like, you know, a cranky dictator's misbehavior. And like, this is what's spiritually true. That's, I think, you know, probably a lot of people have tried to express that theologically at different times, you know. I guess like the bombs and missiles just felt like kind of demons or like sideshows. And this felt like love. Does that make sense? A lot of people have asked me like how they can help or what they can do. And I guess I would say like two or three things. The first is that like the humanitarian crisis is not really less. In fact, it grows over time as like funds run out. And so I gave to that. We did that campaign. Next thing, it's like the social media attention brain, the news cycle attention brain. Like there are no refugee drives now, even though there's just as many refugees who need food today as 3 months ago, but it's not sexy right now. I mean, it still maybe is even, but like there are new things. Whatever attention was needed is still needed. It may be even more because it takes on different tenor as it happens over time. Going over there was helpful to know, okay, this is like what is needed. And actually like what is needed as much as like human contact and support, but also like, you know, the JCC in Krakow is thousands of meals a day. They're feeding people, and like that need isn't less. Or World Central Kitchen, if you go to like a non-Jewish organization, is feeding lots of people at the border. Or the Jewish Community of Poland has a fund that they're using to provide like hotel rooms and housing for people, and food and other things. And just there were people that were taking all of the funds and giving them directly to aid, and like, and that was important. Like, I know I'm, you know, I have the list of places I'm going to give money to, and I had a different list of organizations before I went, and a new one after I, like ones I hadn't heard of or ones that I was going to give more to. Yeah, and I don't know, like long term, you know, because there's so many needs, like how to sustain. But I do think, like, because the refugee experience is so central to Jewish cultural and social and religious consciousness, that maybe, you know, maybe like that woman said, like, maybe we are better poised to know, to ask, to see.
Breakout Sessions is brought to you by Jewish Rhodey Media and made possible by the Jewish Alliance of Greater Rhode Island. Today's episode was edited, produced, and hosted by Emma Newberry. If you enjoyed today's special episode, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, and tell two friends about our show. For more information on Jewish Rhodey Media's projects, you can head to jewishallianceri.org or to jewishrhodey.com, where you can also find us on social media. Thank you all so much for listening. See you next time.